Well, the piano, actually, and my only musical instrument, really, and that was when I was a kid. Yeah, I decided I wanted to learn for some reason when I was about 8 or 9, and my mother went out to work and saved money to buy a piano, and that's where the instrument thing started, I suppose, yeah.
When did you first start fiddling with tape recorders?
Oh, that was late 60s, probably. I was writing conventional music up until then, you know, string quartets and songs and stuff like that, just the usual sort of thing. And then I discovered an old ferrograph monaural tape recorder under the stairs in the music department at Canterbury where I was working. And nobody was using it or anything. And an old ribbon microphone. And I got that going. And that was the start of my fascination with recorded sound. And very quickly, I just shifted completely across to that and stopped writing notes altogether.
Where did you take that microphone and that recorder first? Can you remember?
Oh, it wasn't a portable thing. It was just a great, huge machine.
Oh, really? How big?
Oh, you know, the size of a large printer, I suppose. And but I had this microphone, so I tested it by recording my voice. And I really enjoyed that. I thought it was a really nice thing to do. I didn't have much background in music, formal music, when I went to university, and I always had difficulty with manuscript. I didn't really feel at home. I wasn't really fully literate, I don't think, in that sense. So being able to bypass it and just go straight to the sound suited me really well.
How quickly did that happen?
Oh, over a period of about, from 1969, I think the last conventional piece I wrote was 1977. So there was a very short crossover period. And during that time, of course, Douglas Lilburn was running, I think they were extension courses using the tape recorder in schools. And I went up to Wellington and met him and worked with the machines he had. And he let me go and work in the studio there. And that helped enormously in getting me, you know, facilitating the transition across to that medium. But it didn't take very much encouragement. I just felt completely at home with my own recorded voice. And then from there, recording all sorts of other things.
You didn't have that experience, John, when you first heard your voice played back outside your head that, that's not me?
Oh, no, I had the opposite.
Really?
It's funny, isn't it? When people first hear the recorded voice, they go all funny and laugh and go, oh dear, and they're embarrassed. No, I just thought, oh, this is really, really interesting. Well, and mainly because it was such a direct way of expressing oneself. I was always interested in literature. I actually went to university to study English literature, not music. And I got into music sort of as a secondary thing, really, because I could play the piano a bit. And my mother said, well, we spent all that money on your lessons. You better do some music at university. And so I did just music one as a sort of an extra, and then I swapped over.
We're going to play a piece on Sound Lounge, and it's Parade, which I think you made when you were in Canada in the early 70s.
Yes, 1972, 73, I went on a large, my first sabbatical.
With a dictaphone?
Yes, it was a monaural dictaphone that I bought at the airport with a little dynamic microphone. I wasn't thinking of recording sounds. I was just going to use it as a sort of a diary, you know.
Yeah, and in places it sounds it sounds like a diary, but then in Parade, what you do is mix it all up. And it's the first time, and I was just listening to it a little while ago, that I've heard a sneeze deliberately placed in a work of sonic art. I mean, you hear sneezes in live broadcasts of our concerts all the time, but deliberately placed and used and manipulated for its artistic potential, no, that's the first time. It's a good sneeze, too. Did you get hay fever?
Oh, I was probably in a very dusty, terrible hotel. It was a pretty disastrous sort of trip, really. I had no money. Didn't have enough money. And getting money in those days was so difficult. You didn't have a credit card or anything. So there would be bank drafts that were supposed to be left for me at banks in America. And when I turned up to the bank, they had never heard of me or the bank draft. And this happened regularly. So I was on the bones of my ass most of the time.
You were able to get to our gridiron game, though, weren't you?
Yes. That was probably... I did go to gridiron. I went to ice hockey, too, which was pretty amazing in Canada. But the recordings and parade of gridiron were taken off radio.
Ah. And the same with the... I don't know if there's any ice hockey. There's definitely gridiron, but I don't know if I heard ice hockey in parade.
No, there's mention of ice hockey, I think, in the piece, yes. Well, the interesting thing about that was... You know, I had no idea what I was doing. I mean, the term sonic art or electroacoustic music hadn't even been invented, you know. And even if it had, I wouldn't have known because I was on the other side of the world where any of that was going on. So it just felt like fun, and I sensed that there was something significant maybe that might be able to be made from it. But it was just... absolutely, you know, suck it and see stuff. There was no, I had no real instruction. I mean, Douglas gave me no instruction. He said, here's the key to the studio. Here's how you turn it on. See you later.
I was still a little bit in suspended animation, I think. I don't know what's going to happen when I hit Honolulu. I've managed to get the departure business sorted out. And it's just the arrivals, but that I'm worried about. I think that's the most complicated. It's a very nice apartment Jaroslav has. It's
the fanaticism of the
one bedroom with two beds. The lounge is
to gridiron football. Is just he's bought, all of his furniture that he's bought is Czechoslovakia. American football.
The table is knee high.
Touchdowns.
It's done in
touchdowns.
Well, actually,
touchdowns.
Fine. That kind of green colour. Very thick, heavy table. These, each with three legs. And a bench.
American football.
Which is done in heavy peasant sort of character. A sofa and a couple of chairs done in beautiful upholstery.
Is terrific.
Light brown leather.
Is terrific.
Which he had specially made.
Is terrific. American football is terrific.
Cons and it's just off the main lounge.
Grey cup is
a small apartment, and then a bathroom as well. And that's all there is.
American football is terrific. And as you could hear, there were 60,000 people at that game. That was a semi-final for the Grey Cup. The Grey Cup is like the Manfredi Shield.
How did you edit that sound? Did you bring it back to New Zealand from Toronto?
Yep.
And then how did you edit it? Did you use Douglas Lilburn Studio?
No, by that stage I'd bought enough reel-to-reel tape recorders and a little bit of filtering equipment and so forth, and probably all joined together by junction boxes. It didn't even have a mixer. I transferred it to tape, reel-to-reel tape, and I did it in the studio I was building at Canterbury. That was one of the reasons I went on leave, was to work in and study studios around the world and then come back and build one at Canterbury, and that's what I did.
Did you start distorting the tape itself? Did you start doing things like moving the playback heads? Because you know how you can do that.
I didn't move the playback heads, but you can manipulate the tape manually by just dragging it backwards and forwards.
Yep.
And in those early days, I think there were Revoxes that we first used. They were so basic. They were very good quality, but the mechanisms allowed you to muck around with play the tape on the wrong side, do all sorts of stuff like that. So it was really hands-on stuff. And a lot of razor blade splicing, of course.
New technology makes new sounds possible, and I think maybe makes new revelations possible. For example, the sound of your voice in Parade and other pieces that you've done, you speed it up, you can slow it down, you can run it backwards, all these things, those sounds didn't exist before we had the ability to record our voices and then manipulate the recordings.
Well, that's true. The other thing is, it's interesting because if we had have gone straight to digital technology, the idea of playing a sound backwards, well, it probably would have occurred. I mean, you could play a tape backwards by mistake.
Exactly.
That happened to me. That happened to me once. I did a piece for a dancer who choreographed something, and she asked me to make a tape for it, so I did. And I sent it to her, and I discovered later that she'd paid. I wound the tape tails out to stop print through. She didn't know that, so she played the whole piece in reverse.
Did she like it? Did she say that's great? I really like this, John.
I didn't say anything. She thought it was, you know, this is what I'd provided her with.
Does that piece now exist in its backwards form?
No,
because that's the way it goes.
It doesn't.
It doesn't. You decide to run it forwards.
No, it was just it was very early on, and it was just a sort of a commission from someone to provide a soundtrack for dance. So I didn't think of it as a work, really. But that was quite amusing.
You mentioned,
I discovered that this would happen.
You mentioned, John, the digital world, and I was thinking, does that, now that you can synthesize any kind of sound, has that opened up even more creative possibility for somebody like you?
Well, traditionally there have been two ways of approaching sound in that sense. One is to synthesize it. That is, I mean, a program like C-Sound just builds sine waves together until you can construct, you know, a complicated spectra and make sound that way by synthesizing it. The other way is to work on an extant sound by cutting away the sound, by removing frequencies. And that's the way I've worked. I have never worked synthetically. I always work with a recorded natural sound or any sort of sound and then work out ways to reduce it or stretch it or alter it. And I've always found that has suited me better than the synthetic approach.
You're listening to RNZ Concert and I'm talking to John Cousins on the occasion of his 80th birthday. John, how much of what you've done has made it onto our airwaves on RNZ Concert? Do you know?
Oh, bugger all, I would think. And actually, I don't think that medium... It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, radio is an acousmatic medium. In other words, it's just sound. You look at the little dial on your radio or whatever, and the stuff comes out, and we accept that. But actually, I think acousmatic music, just for the ears alone, with no visual reinforcement, is a really problematic thing when it comes to public, you know, collective performance. I think it's much more suited to a domestic situation where you sit privately in my studio, you can only listen one at a time, and sit in a space that's articulated specially for the sound world, and it's an enclosed, personal, solitary kind of experience. And I think that's where it works best, really.
Have you used the most advanced recording equipment? I mean, the dictaphone wasn't even meant to be for recording stuff for playback.
No.
I
use a little Zoom H2.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but it's old. It'll record four channels, and it's perfectly satisfactory for everything I want.
I've got an H5.
I've got a very good studio microphone.
Have you?
For recording voice, yes.
You talked about that. Is it Studio 174, that little private studio of yours?
That's right.
Why is the one-on-one thing important?
Well, because... it's a 26-channel acousmonium. In other words, it's a loudspeaker orchestra. There are 13 stereo configurations. They sit in three rings of eight surrounding a sweet spot. And that's where I sit and make the work. That's where my head is when I'm making the work. When somebody listens, I take out the workstation, change the configuration slightly, and put their head exactly where mine was when I made the work. So they're in the exact same sweet spot. And they're in the acoustic space where the work was made. And the acoustic space is unique. The way in which the sound behaves in that space, the way in which it reacts to the loudspeaker configurations is unique. And that's what I use when I'm making my compositional decisions. And so that's the ideal replay situation. And the space is completely black. You open your eyes and you cannot see anything. You're blind totally. So that sound, which is usually a secondary, you know, backup to sight, becomes prime because you can't see anything, even with your eyes open. And it's a particular kind of sensory experience that I'm interested in. That's why I now very, very seldom play the multi-channel works anywhere except the studio. It's so much of a compromise that it's, you know, not worth the effort, really.
Do you make that art for us or for you?
I make it for me, but, you know, everybody's in solitary confinement, really. They might not know they are, but they are really. You know, we're speaking. I say something to you and you acknowledge it, but what you're actually getting from it, I wouldn't have a clue, except that it's going to be very different to what I'm intending, really, because our life experiences are unique. And so one makes work to try and find out answers to all the big questions, you know. What's it all about? But also there's a very strong impulse in that process to communicate. You know, you make something that you've spent a lot of time doing and it moves you. And so you say to someone, oh, look what I've made. Do you want to share this as well? But that's actually a secondary thing. If nobody was listening, I'd still be making.
What about the Aeolian harps? Well, are they for listeners or again for you, those harps that you've made?
They're for me. Various people have heard them. You mean the ones on the West Coast?
Mm.
Yes. In fact, I took them down last year. They'd been there for 20 years, but they started to deteriorate, so I removed them. A lot of the locals said to me, where are the harps gone? You know, oh, dear, that's no good. So they established a role for people, I guess. But all I'm saying is that's not why they were put there. They were put there because I was interested in raising these large stones that I'd found on the location off the ground and allowing them to dance and sing. That's what I was interested in doing. And the discoveries that I was discovering about what that meant in the big picture.
How did you make the stones dance in an Aeolian harp?
Well, they were suspended by nylon fishing tackle, actually.
Ah.
And they were symmetrical, so when the airflow moved over the stone, it turned like a propeller. And one way, and then it would reach a hiatus, and then go backward the other way. And then the strings that were suspending it. That's why I did it to start with, just to suspend the stones and allow them to move. And then I heard these sounds completely accidentally, and I realized they are Aeolian tones. And so that meant the stones could sing too, because the stone mass defined what the spectrum would be.
Where's Pituro? That's where the harps are, or were.
Pituro.
Right.
It's at the mouth of the Pituro River. So you go up to Collingwood, drive further north, cross over to the west coast, go down past the Whanganui Inlet, 12 k's south of Mangarako, that's the Pituro River. And that's the place where I've been going for the last 40 years and doing work there.
You talked about the stones.
Yes.
Pituro. And you actually, I was reading the book that Robert Hoskins and Norman Meehan have made with you that came out, The Necessity for Consolation, a few years back. And you talk at one point about the stones at Pituro and how only nature can embed those stones at the high tide mark. And if a human picks them up, he just can't do what nature does.
No.
And I was reading that and listening to your work, it sort of struck me that to some extent what you seem to be doing with your recordings is a little bit like picking up those stones and moving them around.
You're absolutely right. I'm intervening. Van Gogh said, you know, art is nature and man. And that's what makes it interesting. Nature is the pearl, man's the grit. And you stick a bit of grit in the pearl and you get in the oyster. And you get a pearl. If you don't, there's no grit, then you've just got an oyster. And I think that's the thing that I find interesting. And the lessons that one learns when you observe nature and the way in which there's a non-thinking process going on, a non-self-aware process, which makes so much sense to a human being at one level. But the trouble is you get no eye contact from it. It's not about you. It's about it. And what mankind wants is an answer. They want an answer to this ridiculous prison that they're in of their own self-awareness. And that's what produces all art and religion, I think. That's my opinion, anyway.
It's a hopeless task, isn't it, John?
Yes, it's hopeless, but it's also enormously fascinating and interesting. And especially when you get to the stage where, you know, this demise that for all of your life has been over the horizon is suddenly coming towards you at the speed of light, then it becomes extremely interesting.
You're listening to Aaron's Ed Concert, and I'm talking to John Cousins. John, do you know, you said when you were making Parade in the early 70s, you didn't know what you were doing. Do you know what you're doing now?
No, not really. Oh, I've got more of an idea, I think. One of the interesting things about being older is looking back. For example, some of the analog tapes I made in the 72 and 73, I've just been digitizing. Bought myself a new cassette deck with a USB output. And it's digitizing these tapes, and I'm listening to myself raving about stuff, and I think exactly the opposite now. I've gone 180 degrees away from what I thought then and felt. So it could very well, if I lived long enough, it would probably happen again to me now, but I'm afraid that's not going to happen. So I think it's just an ongoing sort of discovery. And I think, you know, people use their lifespan up in a variety of ways. But if you're, for some reason or other, fascinated by your own process, I'm my own case study, really. I mean, because I'm in my solitary cell and I've got to make sense of it, look at the walls, find out something interesting in it, because I'm actually never going to get out of it.
But do you come out and interact with other people, friends, family?
Yeah. I think so. I spent 40 years as a teacher in a university. So I've interacted with lots of people over my lifetime. My biggest thrill, the thing that makes my day, is if someone comes to the studio, sits in the space and listens, and they get the work and I get another set of perceptions listening to the work. That's just fantastic.
So it's a bit more than just for you then, isn't it, John? If that's the buzz you get.
It's, like I said, there's a huge communicative impulse there. But I know that whoever listens to the work is not going to relate to it the way I do. They're going to relate to it maybe partially. Depends how similar to me they are. I suppose it's a signal out of my solitary cell to someone else, and they've turned and they've looked and they've noticed and they've witnessed. And I think everybody is looking for a witness to their lives, aren't they? That's what I'm doing.
Do you listen to much music, John?
Yes, I do. Yes. I listen to a lot of, you know, my favourites, Bach, Beethoven and Brahms.
That's the three Bs. It's not what I expected from an avant-garde composer.
Oh, yeah, I don't listen to much contemporary music.
Why not?
I listen to no electroacoustic music. Because what you're looking for, and I suppose my training as a musician and, a lifetime teaching tonality, teaching how tonal music works, how the hierarchy of tonics functions in a Beethoven string quartet, for example. I mean, that's a marvellous example of a musical language that really does work. And don't get me started about about how pitched music. I find that extraordinarily difficult when the even-tempered scale, even the same instruments, are taken from the tonal era and fractured and divorced from a tonal hierarchy. Then all you've got is a whole lot of pitches all around one another with no ability to make large-scale strategic decisions, and that is really disturbing for me.
Does that mean that Weyburn doesn't work for you?
No, it doesn't work for me.
Even
no.
though, well, I guess this is a thing, John. We're all different. To me,
yeah,
Weyburn is like they're like polished jewels. In fact, they remind me of stones, polished stones on beaches.
Yes. Yes, that's true. The trouble is that I mean, you know, and I don't know the answers of that. I mean, Arnold Schoenberg's early tonal music and his pantonal works up until the Opus 25 Piano Suite, for example, are wonderful. What an amazingly gifted, fantastic composer. And then he goes and democratizes the semitones. He removes from them the one thing that made them work. And then wonders why he can't make large-scale structures from them. So he pinches movements from, you know, neoclassical, like gavotte and jig and so forth. And those are the movements that happen in the Piano Suite, Opus 25, which is his first serial work. And for me, that's just inconceivable. I don't know what the hell was going on in his mind.
And your works, though, if I listen now, was it Frame that you made later on that I was listening to?
You mean within the frame?
Within the frame. And, and there's also the one I was listening to, which is based on a trip to, I think, part of Ireland.
The quarter.
Yes, the quarter. And, you know, this is quite a long... These are works that actually stretch over the length of quite a long symphonic movement. And so there is structure there. If you've chosen to make sound structures, whatever you call them, out of atonality?
I've chosen to make sound structures out of recorded noise, sometimes sounds which you can recognize, and sometimes transform sounds, but I've also used semantic narrative. I've also used a yarn, a story, which is spoken, so I can insert into the works concepts and thoughts and ideas which I communicated that way. And that's what allows me to make larger structures. If I use, you'll be very hard-pressed to find works which only use transformed sounds. There will always be something for the listener to hang their hat on. And that's why it's a completely different genre. That's why I don't call it music. I call it sonic art. But there will always be a narrative, either overt or covert.
Are you still creating now, John?
Too right, every day.
Is there an urgency in what you do now? You referred to that, or alluded to that earlier.
No,
the big 8-0?
No, there's no urgency. There's just more awareness of how lucky I am, I suppose, really. Enormously privileged and lucky to be able to... I mean, the last 20 years, I left the university in 2003. This is my 20th anniversary away from the university, solely making work. And I feel really, really lucky to have been able to do that, really, and to continue to do so.
And you're gathering sounds, with that Zoom 2?
Oh, yes. H2. Yes, I have been a lot lately, actually, because the work's changed and altered in all sorts of ways. But I have a huge resource of field recordings, as you can imagine, and transform files. And more and more I dip into these and use them in different contexts and transform them again or reorient them in various ways.
How do you edit them now? You don't? Do you still use tape?
No. God, no. No, I use Pro Tools as the editing platform I use, and I use various transformational software that's around. Yeah. You know, just the usual way of editing digital files.
What's going to happen to Studio 174 when you die, John?
It'll die too.
Really? After you go, will I not be able to come and visit you in your studio and listen?
No.
Well, if you did, I can't visit you, but I wouldn't be able to come to the studio and listen.
No, you won't, because there's no way the studio will be able to exist. It's in a building, you know, that's used by my partner as well, and there's all sorts of reasons why that won't happen. But the material is all in the Turnbull, and there are very specific specifications of the space. So, but once I'm gone, the instrument will be gone too. So, and actually, even if it was reconstructed to the specifications I've left, the actual acoustic character characteristics of the space could probably never be created, because inside the space I've built a small listening enclosure which uses drapes, and those drapes baffle the sound. They allow it to be more focused, the location and so forth. I don't think you could ever actually reproduce the particular qualities. And more and more and more, I'm using and exploiting those qualities in the work I make. But, you know, I think in the long term, we're all going to be forgotten very quickly. I mean, I just think about composers of conventional music from my previous generation. Someone like David Farquhar, for example. You know, you ask students who he is and they don't even know, you know. I've never heard any of his music. We're all going to be gone pretty quickly. So it's not really a problem. The thing is to have fun while you're still around.